Hey, welcome to Woman Birders Happy Hour. I'm your host and mixologist, Hannah Bushert. I'm a birder, a woman, and someone who enjoys a good drink. Join me as I talk to women from around the world, from all walks of life, that enjoy birds too, about their experiences, what it's like to be a woman birder, and advice they have for others. I'll also have a different cocktail to share with you that pairs nicely with this chat. For this episode, I spoke with Marissa Oliva, whom I first met while living down in the Rio Grande Valley of Southern Texas. She's known worldwide as an advocate for nature centers, environmental education, and the Latinx nature community. I worked with her husband, Roy Rodriguez, while at Benson Rio Grande Valley State Park, and was introduced to her through the Texas Master Naturalist Program. After the program that we were in, the Texas Master Naturalist Program, got to be a fairly large chapter, we then worked with Marissa and a handful of other folks to branch off and create our own Texas Master Naturalist chapter for our section of the Rio Grande Valley. And Marissa was a huge advocate for that and helped to really spearhead that effort. And so I learned a lot from her about nonprofit work and being on a board and partners and things like that. Currently, she is the manager at Edinburgh Scenic Wetlands, one of the premier nature sites in the Rio Grande Valley. She is a fierce, smart, passionate person who inspires others to get excited about nature and wildlife. Marissa has spent a large portion of her life in Texas, and most recently the Rio Grande Valley, in which there are just so many species I would love to make cocktails based on. So hopefully I get some other people to mention them throughout the run of the show. However, she mentions a gorgeous, beautiful summertime species, which is the scissor-tailed flycatcher. Scissor-tailed flycatchers are species found from Texas north to Kansas in the summers and down in parts of Central America during the non-breeding season. In the summers, they're easy to spot while driving the highways as they sit on power lines and fence rows waiting for insects to take wing. They're an elegant gray and peach-colored flycatcher with a long, striking tail, and they're fearless, and they'll attack other animals that come near their nest, and they're just an absolutely gorgeous bird. So that is our drink of the episode. So to make a scissor-tail flycatcher, what you'll need is a shot of vodka, a shot of lemon juice, 8 ounces of club soda, juice from half a peach, or you could use a quarter cup peach nectar, and make sure the peach that you're using is a nice juicy one. You might want to do a taste test first. When I first made this, my peach wasn't super flavorful, and ice. And if you want to make it a mocktail instead, just leave out the vodka and it'll be a nice peach soda. So directions, fill a glass with ice. Add vodka, lemon juice, and then top it off with the soda water. And then juice the peach or pour in the peach nectar into the glass. Gently stir it and serve. This drink is based on a drink that was created in West Texas, specifically Lubbock. It's said that Dr. Chilton wanted a drink that was strong and citrusy and not too sweet. He walked up to a bartender at the Lubbock Country Club and asked for a vodka, lemon, and club soda. And the Chilton was born. And then I came along and added peach to it, and then the scissor-tail flycatcher was born. The scissor-tail flycatcher is a good summer drink. It's bright, refreshing for a hot day. The sweetness of the peach complements the boldness of the vodka in this simple drink. Club soda is refreshing, and it's a great drink for sitting on a porch and watching the scissor-tail flycatchers catch dragonflies. So grab whatever you've got to drink, whether it's this cocktail that we've made for this episode, coffee, wine, water, or something else, for another interview with an amazing woman birder. I hope it inspires you, I hope it educates you, and I hope that it helps us work together to build an even better birding community that's supportive and accepting of all. And please enjoy this happy hour. Well, let's start off. Would you please tell us about yourself?
Hi, so my name is Marissa Oliva. I am the manager of the Edinburgh Scenic Wetlands and World Birding Center down in Rio Grande Valley and down in Deep South Texas. I've been here in the valley since 2001. I met my husband shortly thereafter, but we weren't married until very, very late in life. And he is a birder. And so through him, I've definitely learned some birding down here in the valley, and then also with a lot of great birders that were down here that were mentors early on. When I came down, I started at Benson Place to really delve into birding here in the Rio Grande Valley. Before that, I was in, I worked in lots of different places. I worked in Florida, and I was in Maryland. I was, my background's environmental education. And so I did that in lots of different places and traveled. I got to travel a lot in my younger years. But yeah, I've been down here in the valley since 2001 and really love it here and have kids now. So yeah, pretty planted.
And it's what, like 110 degrees there right now or something crazy?
Yeah, it's hot. It's definitely hot. Every day I'm like, I can't wait for fall. I can't wait for fall. So it's coming. But it'd be nice when the weather cools down and it's a little bit more pleasant. Right now the morning's okay, but you know, you get to the afternoon and you just don't want to be out there.
So how did you start your career in environmental education?
So I started, you know, this is a long road. I'm sure that there are moments in your lifetime as a childhood that sort of got you inspired and thinking along these lines. And mine started the same way. I was always big. I was always overweight. I was always chubby. I wasn't really athletic. I didn't do any sports. I was very shy. Didn't like to talk a lot, if you can believe that. And so anyway, when I was in high school, I started blossoming and getting involved a little bit more. And my mother was really involved with the neighborhood association, and there we had a cleanup, and she organized a big cleanup. And this man named Mr. Kell came out with this canoe to help clean our lake. And he invited me to help him clean up the lake in the canoe. And he would, you know, he had me trapped in there. No, it wasn't trapped. It was a lot of fun. And he encouraged me to join this organization called Explore Post. And it was a co-ed Boy Scout group that girls could be in. And I was 14, never did anything like that. He offered to drive me. So my parents didn't have to drive me, and he would drive me to the meetings. He was in charge. And through that, I got to experience backpacking, hiking, canoeing, spelunking. And so here's this little chubby, overweight Latina girl, and never having done any of this before. I had a family where we would go off, and we lived in San Antonio, so we would explore, you know, Lady Bird Johnson and the wildflowers, and we'd go out. But I really didn't do any of this stuff, this hiking and backpacking and canoeing and spelunking. And I did that for 4 years. And so when I got to college, I wanted to continue to do that. But one of the big experiences that I had growing up doing that was that I was the only person who looked like me anywhere when we went cave diving, when we went hiking canoeing in Big Bend, we went hiking in Colorado, these amazing places, these amazing experiences. And if there was any other Hispanic, it was, you know, one or two people who were with us in organization. We were in San Antonio, it was still mostly Anglo, you know, Anglo white kids, and me by myself, or maybe one or two others. And then no one who looked like us on the trails. And so that was kind of this, you know, momentous, like, why aren't people who, you know, why aren't my people out here? Why aren't they experiencing this? Why aren't they seeing the marmots and the wildflowers and, you know, and going down the rapids and all these really incredible, amazing things that I didn't even know existed. And so when I got to college, I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do stuff in the outdoors, and I wanted to get people who look like me excited about nature. And that's kind of been my lifelong mission. And so it took me a while at A&M to kind of figure out the right department, but I eventually landed in wildlife and fisheries in Nagel Hall at Texas A&M. And that was a, you know, department where I found a home. And even though I never really went the scientist route, what I found that I was really good at was taking the scientific concepts and simplifying it for the layman. And so I started getting into environmental education. I got into Project Wild way back then. Like I got trained in it at A&M. So I guess I was early on, and so I've been a big proponent of Project Wild because it's been with me. I've been using it my entire career. And yeah, so everywhere I've been, everywhere I've went, it's been about, you know, it's not exclusive to Latinos, it's to everybody, but, you know, getting people, especially, you know, children of color, to realize what an incredible world we live in and what we're a part of, and that we can make a difference, and we can, you know, when we grow up, when we vote, we're going to make an impact. And so learn about the world. Let's learn about the world that's around us, that we are part of, that we can help, that, is important to us and our health. And so that's been the trajectory. And then, you know, what better place than to end up in the Rio Grande Valley, where it's 90% Hispanic. So it's really easy to accomplish the mission that I want to accomplish, which is to get people who look like me or similar out there in the world with everybody else, right? You know, not to displace anybody, but just to be out there as part of it. And so, yeah, that's.
So have you seen like the people in the Rio Grande Valley reciprocate? I mean, is it effective that you're out there showing these kids what they can be doing?
Absolutely. The whole, you know, build it and we will come. When I started here in the Valley, we had no World Birding Centers. The World Birding Center concept had developed, and it was, and that was well before me. That was Madge Lindsay and a couple of really key people. I'm forgetting names right now, and I'm sorry, but there are some really key people who made that happen. Andrew Sampson was a part of it way in the beginning, where they saw this, you know, we have this fantastic place in Texas where the birds were and people traveling from all over the country. And so they're like, we need to build this tourism mecca. So they have this World Birding Center concept. It started with, they were going to have one place, in one place only, but there was a lot of competition, and it ended up being eventually 9 places, 9 centers. And I was here at the very beginning of that starting up. So when I came into Benson State Park, it wasn't a World Birding Center yet, but it was going to become a World Birding Center, and all these other sites were being funded. And so I got to be part of that initial, I was a peon, but I was in there saying, hey, what about the locals? What about, you know, what about environmental education? And the beginning, they were like, no, this is, you know, tourism. This is bringing people in. This is bringing money in. And I'd be one of those, you know, what about the locals? And sure enough, when we opened up our buildings, we found, hey, you got to serve the locals. You got to have environmentation. Otherwise, your buildings are empty and there's nobody coming, because the tourism is a very short season down here. But you've got millions of people who live here who can be served by this and who can grow and become a part of it. And that's what's happened. And so, yeah, when I was here, the only, you know, again, a place where we have 90% Hispanics, and the only 2 Hispanic people that I knew that were in the profession were Roy, my husband now, Roy Rodriguez, and my gosh, I'm forgetting his name, and he works with the ABA American, or ABC, I forget the name, I forget his name, I'm sorry, I don't know why I'm blanking, but anyway, but there's only 2, so everybody else I knew was not part of it. Yeah, there's 2. Say it again.
Was it Jesus?
Jesus Franco. Yes, Jesus Franco. Okay. So I knew Jesus and I knew Roy, and that was it. And so, but we have seen through the efforts of a lot of people, not just me, but I've definitely been a part of it, of a growth. And now we have incredible birders down here. You know, if you look at Javier, I met Javier when he was an undergrad, or that he was undergrad at our, and UTRGV, and he was interested, right? I think he was really interested in snakes at first. He was a biology student. He joined the master naturalist class, and I was the education coordinator for that class here at Edinburgh, and he joined that, and we have watched his trajectory, right? He started off as an undergrad. He worked at 3 or 4 different nature centers. He worked here for a while. He became the assistant manager at Benson. Now he's a superintendent at Soriana Grande. He's getting recognized for all his work. And so, yeah, I mean, he's not the only one. We have Javier Gonzalez, who's over on the island, mm-hmm. South Padre Island. And, you know, so we've watched, you know, a lot of people grow through here. A lot of, you know, Becky Reyes, she works for here. Monica De Leon worked here. You know, so we have, we've grown these birders, these people who are getting recognition, who are moving up in the world, who are taking these lead and supervisory roles. And then we also have just the general public, families who utilize this for education, but are growing, you know, young men and women, right? Little girls and boys that are turning to young men and women that are birders. And so we have definitely have seen the change here. And it's been around 20 years, but it's happened. It's still a short time frame, considering how far we are in so many other places where we're struggling to grow birders that are representative of the areas that they're from, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's exciting. And you were here too. I don't know what your experience was like. I mean, I know if you are not from the valley, it can be a big culture shock. It's really hard because people are very tight-knit. Like if you're, I'm not from here originally, I'm from San Antonio and I traveled a lot. So I didn't go to school here. I didn't build a network of friends. So it took a long time to grow friendships. And, you know, luckily I have my family here. For people who don't live here, they come down here and you don't have family, you don't have friends. And sometimes it's hard to break in. It takes, you know, I know a lot of people who come for a few years, do really great things, and then, like you, move on.
Well, you know, when we moved there, like we became, you know, just instantly part of the Master Naturalist family, and Javier and Roy, you know, they were so great at including us. So like when we moved to Houston, we were like, how did we have this great, you know, network of friends in the valley, and why did we leave them?
Well, there's a lot of the world to see. And see, that's one of my things is that we're growing birders down here. We're growing naturalists and birders and herpetologists and people who, you know, love the environment and are, you know, want to do good things in this world. But getting them through the pipeline, getting them out here, getting them, you know, getting them to move, be able to move on, and that's been tough. Like, whereas what I see is that people from schools that are not in the Rio Grande Valley, like if they go to big schools up in the Northeast, there's a lot of opportunities that you're exposed to that you can do working at national parks part-time, traveling to different places. And a lot of times there's a support network that isn't always available here to all students. And so what happens is that, you know, we see people who aren't from these areas who come up from north from these, you know, great schools, move down here, get some experience, and then move up the ladder very quickly. And we're not seeing that as much with our locals. I mean, they're going to UTRGV, they're getting great experiences here, but it's not recognized always. And so that's been the new struggle is, okay, now we've created this group of people. Now we have all these fantastic birders. How do we get them hired to the next level? How do we get them the next full-time job? How do we get them the next gig? How do we help them? And so that's something we're struggling with is, and then the other thing that we're struggling with is that our families don't want us to leave. They want us to stay. So that's the other thing is being able to break that bond enough for somebody to get that next level experience so they can earn that paycheck and start a career path that they can support themselves and start a family and can then come back here, right? Or start a new gig, but they need that experience. And that's also a struggle that we have. So
Yeah, that's definitely something. I wonder if, you know, like having these partnerships, because you're part of the ANCA, right? The Anka
yes.
Nature Center. I bet those partnerships can really help, you know, get some of these folks to different areas around the country, so they can have, you know, the different experiences.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's what we're working on. Working through ANCA, working through Parks and Wildlife, a lot of partnerships in Parks and Wildlife too. And so, it's slow going, but there is some movement. I want to see more. I think we have a lot of great people, you know, and I want to see them everywhere. So.
I totally agree. So you said Roy is really like the one that got you into birds, right?
No,
So
actually, he's helped me. I still, and of course I'm biased, but I've always felt Roy was one of the greatest birders and teachers out there because he is so patient. I mean, I don't know many birders. I've not been with many birders who will sit and stare at a cardinal and make sure that you understand everything about that cardinal before you move on to another bird, right? Other bird, oh, that's a cardinal, and then move, oh, that's this and that's that, right? So he is one of those who spends an inordinate amount of time making sure that you know, because he was a guide, so whoever he's with sees that, understands, and learns. So I did learn and pick up a lot from him. Now with kids, for both of us, it's a lot harder getting out there in the world. By the way, you have a black shadow behind you.
I know, my she likes to help.
Okay. But yeah, but actually at Benson, there was a lot of great role models early on, people who were willing to, and that's the one thing about my entire life. Is that I've been lucky that there's been so many people every step of the way, starting with Mr. Kell, who said, "Hey, I think you can do this." And luckily, I had it in me to say okay or yes, and say yes. I didn't start saying no until I got this job here at the Birding Center, became manager, and I was getting offers to do other things, and I was like, "I just started here. I'm not ready to leave." So I until I got here, I was not, I just said yes. And I had a lot of people who were willing to mentor me and help me. And at Benson, the volunteers that were there, my case, he was one who would go out with me and share stories. So a lot of the stories that I have about nature that I share with other people came from people like Mike Hayes. And yeah, there was just a lot of great volunteers back in Benson. I don't know if they were around when you were there, but and forgive me, it's been a while, but like Rose, I think it's Rosie.
Oh, I think Rose, like, I feel like her husband had just died or something when I got
Yeah,
there, so I
unfortunately
didn't get to meet them.
they were elderly when I was there, and so a lot of them have passed away. So those first great mentors, but they were willing to take somebody like me in and show me around and tell me the stories. And I was young and single and could spend all the time I wanted out there absorbing everything and talking. And so yeah, that's how it started. And then Master Naturalist helped. And so yeah, I've had a lot of great mentors to help guide me. And I think that's really important. I think for any young person in starting this world, it helps to have people who are willing not to just like to welcome you, right? And to be a mentor and to be patient, and that's I've had been lucky to have that, and we need to help facilitate more of that.
So how would you suggest if people are looking for mentors, either in birding or in their career field or something like that, how do you go about finding somebody?
So it helps to be a little bit outgoing and talkative and basically, hang out in the places where the birds are. Start up conversations. Sometimes we want to be really guarded, so kind of bringing your guard down a little bit and giving people a benefit of doubt, that helps. I mean, it's not always easy. But yeah, if you can if you ha if you're not working, if you're not employed, volunteering is a great way to get in. I always encourage volunteering because it's a way for people to get to know you. A lot of the staff we have here started off as volunteers. We got to see their work ethic and how intelligent they were and how dynamic they were, and we're like, we want you. Becky was one of those, Monica was one of those, Veronica was one of those. So a lot of staff that are here, they started as volunteers, and they got to know us to know whether or not they wanted to work for us. So that helps is getting volunteering, and then, like I said, just kind of hanging out. Roy is different, and he did a lot of seeking out. I don't know if all of us are brave enough to go out there and seek out, but he did, and so he would find people. Sometimes he, I don't know if it's because he's a man, and he was a Latino man, Hispanic man, that he, I think, had a rougher entry into this world. I felt like I was nurtured and coached and welcome. And yeah, there would have been some people who would be a little bit dismissive, but for the most part, I was nurtured and coached into it. Whereas I felt like he had, in his early years, a lot of barriers thrown up, a lot of people who just weren't willing to give him the time or the effort. But he did find a few people who, and he said they were the outcasts, who would spend lots of time with him. And that's how he learned it. Now he's, like I said, he's a great birder. I'm still don't consider myself this birder. I love birds and love nature. It's all part of this giant circle. Whereas he can read a book. He has a photogenic memory. He can read a book and take somebody guiding in Alaska. And he's done this, read all the birds, learned all about them, flew to Alaska and guided for a week and was able to take them everywhere they needed to and find all the birds they wanted. I don't know how many people can do that. Yeah. I can't do that. I can't read a book and regurgitate like he can. I mean, he just, inherit, just gets it all in there. But like I said, I think he had a rougher entry into it, but he just had a passion and a desire, and he really absorbed a lot of it. So I think different personalities, different people are going to have different barriers. I definitely think, when we know for sure that African Americans are facing barriers that the rest of us aren't getting, they're not being welcome. They're not being made to feel like, hey, you belong here, or come with me, or learn this. And we definitely need to be cognizant of that and make sure that we are rolling out the welcome mat and then not feeling, understanding when they still might be a little bit I don't know if I could trust you, because they've had so
Yeah.
many instances where they can't trust somebody. So, you know, I think that is all our role. All our roles are to make sure that we're welcoming to everybody and be cognizant of those who aren't feeling welcomed, and making our world, this world that is definitely our world, a big home for everybody.
Yeah, that's a lovely call to action. So what has been your most memorable bird that you've ever seen?
So I call it, everybody has their spark bird, and my spark bird, the bird I always remember, even though I didn't grow up here, this was always my second home. It's where my grandparents were, my mom's parents, and every winter, every summer, we would drive down here, and on our drives, we didn't have the iPads, we didn't have any devices to, so we'd be staring at the window, and it was always the scissortail flycatcher. That long, beautiful tail, and they'd be on the wires. And so that was always a sign that we were getting to the valley. That and the palm trees, were the two things we're getting to the valley. And so that was the bird that I always remember. But you can't be down here in the valley and not have some really incredible birdie moments, even when it's something, something pretty common. Like out here, we have chachalacas everywhere all the time, like at Benson, and just having them, watch the babies walking around, or they're on top. I mean, they're just so close to you, and just watching them is a lot of fun. We've had other moments that were pretty unusual. We had the mango hummingbird appear here, and that was super exciting. And we had the long-eared owl, and finding the bird. Actually, I've never found the bird. It was our groundskeepers who always found the bird, but coming across it. So you have those big birds, but then you just have those quiet moments where you're just walking out. We've been hearing the cuckoo call a lot. The yellow-billed cuckoo is constantly calling, and I didn't really recognize it. And I was like, "Are you sure that's what it is?" And I was going through all the songs to make sure, because I've never heard this before. I've never heard this call, but it's the call it makes here, and it's this bird, and it makes this call. And I found a recording that matched it. I'm like, okay. So, moments of discovery, moments of wonder. There's a lot here. The one thing that I love about the valley is that I call it easy birding, because our trees are so short. Like up where you are, if you want to see a bird that's migrating, you have to like stare up, and you're looking at little
Oh,
buds
yeah.
way up there, right? And here
Yep.
they're like, come out at 10 o'clock. They're on the water, sit, and you're looking. You don't have the neck strain that you do, and they're closer. So I think, valley birding is a lot more fun, and it's very easy to get into, because there's so many, they're so close, they're so colorful. You get, summer, winter, fall, you get all the different patterns. And so, yeah, it's just a fun place to observe birds and bird behavior.
Well, and that's what's so different about the valley is that you can just set out a feeder and there's just birds all over the feeder all day long. I mean, like I have a feeder right in front of me and I haven't seen a bird this whole time that we've been talking. They're just, I don't know. I mean, they're common, there's abundant, birds in our area, but it's just not, the valley is just a whole different place. It's hard to describe. What advice do you have for women looking to get into birding or already into birding and maybe into environmental education work like you do?
It kind of the same kind of things. Like if you're young and you have a chance to work and not make money, do a little bit of that. You do a little volunteering. Get your face known. Start networking that way. Visit the nature centers around you. Grab a big map and go out and discover the places. And if you can bring a friend with you, if you can bring your mom or your dad or a neighbor or a friend to go out with you, even if they're not into it, maybe there's something that they'll be into that, while you're exploring. And eventually, you get to know places. If you're brave enough to go at it alone, go at it alone. When you come to nature centers, they've got staff, they've got people, so they're pretty safe places to go if you're by yourself. And I've traveled by myself, as I'm sure you have. And it can be scary. So if grab somebody if you're not comfortable, and even if they're not into it, even for an hour, but get out to these sites that are around you. There's nature centers everywhere. There's, wildlife refuges and just lots of places to go. So that's one, getting out there, getting exposed to the environments that you're in and the people that you're around. The other thing is, you know, this whole world of the internet. We have the World Girl Birders, and then there's another girl, or not girl, like women birders group. So there's these
women,
women in birding, I think. So you have, and I'm very bad with names, which is why I'm not like the great birder. You can take it, remember names. But there are a lot of places where you can connect online and you can just reach out and say, hey, I'm going birding to this area. Is there anybody there that I can meet up with? And like I said, be open to people willing to help you. I mean, people are going to have all sorts of personalities. Not everybody's going to be the perfect person, but everybody has something to give and you can learn from them and just be open to people and what they're willing to share and, you know, be a little sponge with the information they're sharing. So I think, yeah, if you're interested in the world at all, whether it's birds or lizards or, you know, insects or just nature and the environment, just get outside. And even in COVID times, maybe we can't interact with people like we want to, but we can still get outside. The other thing, the most helpful thing, you know, one of the most helpful things is grabbing a book. So you've got some great field guides out there. I know I'm not supposed to like say one or the other, but personally, I really always like David Sibley's books because I like the way he lays out information makes a lot of sense for me. So, but there's a lot of great guides out there, National Geographic and Stokes. And so what I would just say is go through all the books, go to a bookstore, go online, start a collection, be like my husband who does it better than I do and study. And, you know, there's also great websites like I forget which one I use. I think it was Cornell for the bird songs. Listen to bird songs.
Oh, yeah.
If you have an ear, you can just listen to bird songs and listen for that. So there's a lot of great ways. I mean, even just going outside with the journal and, or camera, right? And taking pictures, taking notes, using iNaturalist. If you're interested, you start building up that information and that experience. And then eventually when COVID is over, the contacts with human beings again in person. And yeah, I mean, that's my basic advice.
So in your career, you know, in environmental education and birding and all this stuff, have you ever felt that your gender impacts how you go about it?
I feel, so it is interesting. Gender definitely does play a role, whether it's how we interact with the world or how the world interacts with us. I have a mostly female staff, at least the indoor team. And then the groundskeepers are men. I have had one female. A lot of that has worked its way because we do a lot of education here and we're always looking for people who have experience working with kids as well as science background. And a lot of times that's females. And we have hired males. And there is a difference. There is a difference in the way, and this is, we've had some great guys who've worked here, right? I mean, you know, Javi, you know, love Javi, De Leon, right? I mean, he was mm-hmm. great, and we've had other guys, and what helped them with a mostly female team and all female bosses is that they were very easygoing, roll with the punches. You know, sometimes, you know, girls and guys, feathers will get ruffled. Like, you know, I can't say I'm the perfect boss. I know I do things that, you know, get people upset. But you know, they were willing, you know, willing to go different ways. And then we've had sometimes men who had a very strict structure of how they perceived the world and how they took instruction, and they wanted to be catered to. And mm-hmm. that's been hard for us. So as female bosses here, I have all female supervisors. You know, that's sometimes our struggle is in being bosses to men who aren't used to the subordinate role and believe that what they want is the best thing right? And they don't always understand the culture or the whole picture. And so us learning how to guide, how to be mentors ourselves, to some gentlemen who were just very firm in who and how they think, you know, things should work.
Sure.
And so that's definitely a struggle that we've had. When it comes to customers and people, I mean, I've definitely had experiences. I mean, where people have, you know, whether intentionally or intentionally have been demeaning or insulting or dismissive. I think all of us have had that. And, you know, I've had it a lot of times from the, you know, I could probably feel it most with a certain group, I guess you can call them Karens, who I've run into in this world, right? You know, there's been a few of those, but it's very rare, fortunately. So how it's impacted me in my younger years, I think I was impacted more. Like I had an experience at Benson where I early on, like, because I worked there for about a year, where I went to greet a group of winter Texan type birders, right? People on tour. And yeah. I went to approach them and I was like, hey, how are you? Welcome to Benson, yada, yada, yada. And this older gentleman grabbed my face and planted a kiss on me. And I'm like,
whoa,
20 something. And he planted a kiss and he's like, you'll never forget me now. And the whole group erupted into laughter. And I was shocked and I didn't know what to do. And I didn't really have at the time, like a boss that I felt was very protective of me. And so I've definitely been protective of my female staff when things like that have happened here, because we've had instances where, you know, things have gotten uncomfortable. So I've had that. And I think in my younger years, I was more susceptible to that. And so I'm cognizant of the female staff that aren't bosses, because it takes a while to grow the boss skin. It takes a while to grow the authority of, you know, I belong here. And, you know, and for people to get that in your tone of voice and your mannerism. And so early on, definitely it was more susceptible. Not so much anymore, but it does happen to the other females that I work with, where they, you know, interact with the guy who's being a little bit too aggressive, you know, sexually aggressive, or using sexual terms, things that make them uncomfortable, right? And so, you know, learning how to deal with that and make sure that the staff look comfortable, but we're following all procedures. I mean, those have been issues. So how do I get along with in the world? Fine, I guess, because I'm a boss now. And in my own little tiny corner, okay. I do feel sometimes, you know, in different situations, a little bit more dismissed, that my voice doesn't count. But I also know that there's many, many more times where I am viewed as authority in many situations. And so people do listen to me. But that's taken a lot of time. And, you know, I'm in my mid-40s now. So anyway.
Yeah, well, and I think that's something that's probably pretty common with younger women. I mean, I started at Benson when I was 24, I think. And, you know, granted, people have been coming to the Valley and have known Rory for many, many years. But there were a lot of folks that would come to the park and they would, like, totally just walk past me and, like, want to talk to Roy or want to talk to Melissa or something.
Right.
Yeah. So, but you know, it's also great that, well, it's not great that you've had the experiences with people being uncomfortable, but because you've had those, then you can look out for your younger staff or your female staff to see, you know, if you've come into this situation, like, you can come talk to me, or you can, here are steps to do. Because I know when I was at Benson, I was at the Hawk Tower one day, and this guy, probably the same age as me, just came to the tower, and I was there by myself, and he just got really creepy. But, you know, I didn't know what to do about that sort of situation, because I had never had anybody talk to me about it.
Yeah.
So that's some great insight that you have into
And I mean, it hasn't. I mean, I know that I've had a lot of missteps, and there was times that I were, especially early on, where I was too, I wasn't authoritative enough. I let it go on really long. So it is a learning journey, and I'm definitely not perfect. And there are instances where people are like, but what about that time? Because I didn't put my foot down, but yeah, you learn to recognize and help guide your staff, your, you know, both female and male, to be cognizant of that, of our own behavior and of the behavior of others, and how to make sure the situation is safe for everybody. And so, yeah, it's definitely still an issue. I don't want to make light. There is still an issue out there. And so I think as bosses, we need to be cognizant and have those conversations and make sure, especially this younger staff and the staff that feel more vulnerable, know where to turn to, who to call, how to get help, how to protect themselves, and how to, you know, one of the things that a lot of the supervisors, you know, there's been a lot of coaching of the supervisors on how to develop that authority, because especially, one of my staff who's not here anymore, she had a really difficult time in the first couple of years with, you know, getting people to respect her, to believe her. And one of the things that I talked to her about was that she always prefaced whatever she was going to say with, I think, or maybe, or should, even if she knew 100% that that was a neotropic cormorant, well, I kind of think, and so I, you know, so there's a lot of coaching in that. And I think as females, we want to be inclusive and we want to mentor and we don't want to be, you know, seen as the hard authority. So we do that. We tend to undermine ourselves without knowing by using these words and without speaking. If we know something's like 95%, say, look, it's that, you know, it's da 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 da, and this is why da da da. And if you're wrong, if you listen to a guy out there in the birding world, he'll say, oh, yes, it's da 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 da. And then if he's like my husband, who will admit to his faults, he'll say, oh, wait a second, I was wrong. That's actually not this. It's this, and this is why it's this. But when he first said it, he gave that authority. So people listened, right? And we don't do that as well. And so we have to develop that habit a little bit better, not to say that we're perfect and to definitely, oh, I was wrong. It's not that. But when we're pretty confident, making sure that we sound confident. And so that's, you know, that's another difference with women that I see in birding is it, you know, and that's maybe why we feel more comfortable sometimes with each other than we do with guys, because women are less likely to be dismissive, I think, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Other women are going to be less likely to dismiss us on our commentary because they also do that habit, whereas we will be dismissed very quickly by men or if a man is in the room. So if I had two birders and one was female and one was male, they're going to listen to the man. Even if he's the younger birder, the lesser birder, you know, the less knowledgeable, they'll listen to them. A lot of times it's the way that we're speaking. And then also the impression. So, no,
Eric and I run into that a lot when we're guiding at things that, you know, I've birded a lot more in the valley than he has since that was my job when I was there. And a lot of people will like defer to what he's saying, even though he won't be talking, I'll be talking. And then people will just look at him.
So what does he do? How does he support you in those moments?
He you know, he hasn't quite figured out like a successful strategy other than to just try to defer attention back to me and say like, you know, like, well, Hannah's saying it's a, you know, yellow crown night heron or something like that. But sometimes he doesn't recognize it either. And every time he starts mansplaining, I will just call him out right away and say, you know, stop it. I don't appreciate being treated that way. And he stops. But it's some, you know, it's training. When he was a kid, you know, and through high school and everything like that, he was trained to be a certain way. And so a lot of it's trying to retrain so he doesn't do that to me and he doesn't do that to other people.
Yeah.
Not that he's bad about it at all.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I understand. I mean, for our dynamic, for Roy and I, if we're out there, I'm always going to defer to him because he is the birder. I consider myself a facilitator. He's the shining star in a lot of times. Like even with our kids' life, you know, I'm the one who like make sure they have the crayons and the paper and the art supplies, but he's the one who actually gets in there and does a lot more playing than I do because, you know, he's a really good teacher and that's where he really shines. So, you know, that lets me wash dishes or do other things. And so, yeah, he's a...
as long as you're like in agreement with your roles, you know, I feel like that's really important.
Sometimes. Sometimes you need to get in here and help with the kids. yeah. So anyways.
So my last thought for you is, so you're in the valley, which is one of the burning hotspots in the country and the world probably. Do you feel that the birding community, and there's thousands of people that come to the Rio Grande Valley every year to look at birds, do you feel that the birding community is has worked towards inclusivity to women, or is there still a lot of work to be done?
I think down here we have really strong female birders, like Mary Gustafson, who's been part of this community forever. We have a lot of nature centers that are, you've got female leads like myself and female staff who are in charge. So, I mean, I would like to see more, like when it comes to in the Rio Grande Valley Birding Festival, for example, they have a lot of females that are in charge of the festival. But I would definitely like to see more females that are instructing and guiding. And what thankfully Mary Gustafson has been a really big proponent, because this is a discussion that we've had down here of, the locals need to be part of this. Like, the locals are the ones birding down here. The locals know where all these hotspots. Yes, bring the birders from wherever, right down here, the big guides, but make sure our locals are partnered with them. Because they're the ones who know all the spots anyway, and they can learn from this. So luckily, Mary Gustafson has been a very big proponent, and she has included a lot of our staff from all the different centers as guides. I don't know if that was happening when you were down here, but it's definitely.
And we actually led with Becky this year on one of the field trips.
Okay, well, there you go. So yeah, so luckily she's been a big proponent. So that's gotten better, but I definitely would like to see in the Birding Festival circuit more females in the leading the guiding role. Of course it's identifying them, and I know that sometimes that can be a struggle, so it's good that we have the world the girl world girl birding groups and all these Facebook groups that help us identify each other. I would say it's, I don't know, I'm trying to think. I mean, we have quite a number of female leaders, whether or not they're actually bird guides, they're the ones leading the organization. So I think we're okay on that front. I mean, everything can always be improved. I need diversity on my staff. I mean, we're a fairly heavily Latina staff here. I guess we could say we represent the valley, except in our gender ratio. So we could use diversity down here. And so that's something we're cognizant of. I think all of us can improve in some aspect. But yeah, I think if you're a female wanting to bird as a hobby, I don't see any barriers down here. You've got the Master Naturalist, you've got the Audubon group, you've got 20 some nature centers. You can, sometimes there's seasonal work, sometimes there's jobs, there's definitely volunteer work, and then there's just all these organizations, all these people you can go birding with. I don't know. What about, do you have an opinion on that on the Valley? And
Well, I feel like the valley is just, I talk a lot about when I was in Oregon before I moved down to the valley. I was, very novice birder. I thought I like knew something, and then I moved down to the valley, and it was like, wow, I was an idiot. I didn't know anything about anything. And Roy and Javier were great mentors for me, in getting more involved in birding and learning about these things. And the valley that I found was very supportive and inclusive, and I had a lot of great folks who were asking me to help with things, giving me opportunities to volunteer. I volunteered at your oh
Expo.
gosh, the Halloween thing,
Oh yeah.
with the aliens, and I
Yeah.
still wear that t-shirt all the time that you gave me. So I feel like in the valley it is really inclusive, and people do make a huge effort to get other people involved and feel included, which was something that, I didn't really even realize until we left. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so dumb. Why did we leave? But, I think that's also kind of an anomaly in a lot of these communities. And there are things that other communities can do to try to be more inclusive to women, like you said, like get more guides that are women at festivals, because if you look at the background of festivals, a lot of them are put together by women, are staffed and supported by women, and then most of the guides and speakers, the keynote speakers, are men. So I think that's a really good point of something that could be done. And Mary has done a great job of that. I think she said at one point it was like 10% female guides, and now it's up to somewhere near like 40 or something like
Yeah,
that. So
so I like I said, there's always little, ways that all of us can work on improving, but I think she's done a great job of bringing the locals and then bringing female and being cognizant of those issues. Maybe, I don't know if it's big enough yet, but it'd be interesting to have like a birding tour for like that was just females, say, just birding for women, all women, I don't know. I don't know if that would go,
yeah.
but and I'm really bad about giving other people work to do, so I don't want to put that in the world to make
Don't put
people.
that on my plate.
Yeah, no.
Well, thank you so much, Marissa. I really appreciate you being on my show. Is there any last thing that you'd like to say, or how can people find out more about you and the work that you do?
Sure. Well, I definitely, I know COVID's kind of restricting all of us right now, but when everything's open and you're ready to come down the valley, the birds are still here. And so we got a big hurricane, which I don't know if you know this. We had a lot of damage to the site, so we're still cleaning up, but things will be okay. And all that rain means a lot more growth. So we should be having a good fall with all the growth that we're having, all the flowers that are already popping out. And so anyway, the birds are here. Whenever we're ready, you're ready to come down. And so if you haven't been to down to South Texas, if you haven't been to the Edinburgh World Birding Center, if you haven't been down to Benson or Estero or South Padre Island or McAllen, Quinta Mazatlán or any of these Valley Nature Center. I mean, there's 29 states, and I'm sorry not saying them all, but there are a lot of great birding sites down here in South Texas, a lot of great nature sites, a lot of places that aren't even these sites with buildings, but are back roads and refuge tracks that you can go explore and just see the diversity of birds. If you come down here in the right part of the year and you're willing to drive for all day long, you can get 200 birds down here in a day. So yeah, Valley is if you haven't been down here, come down here. It's not too expensive to stay in, it's not too expensive to eat in. The wintertime weather is great for the most part. Fall through spring, great. Summer, a little hot, a lot hot. But yeah, it's a great place to be if you have a chance to work down here. I think it's a great place to work. You might have to, work on making connections and joining groups so that you can start to meet people. But it is a wonderful place. There's a lot of great places in the U.S., but I definitely love being here in the Valley, and I hope more people will come and see us.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you again, Marissa, for joining me for this episode. I think I'm getting a little better at fixing those audio issues, so hopefully it was a little easier to listen to from my end. Marissa is a great friend of mine, and I so enjoyed getting to talk to her since I haven't seen her for a while. And it was great catching up about all the cool things that Edinburgh Scenic Wetlands is doing, especially in the age of COVID and not being able to welcome as many people to our nature sites. Or being able to interact with them in the way that we used to. Well, thank you so much again, Marissa, and thank you all for listening to my podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, maybe learned something. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Stitcher and Apple Podcasts and Google Music and anywhere else you listen to me. If you'd like to connect with me on the socials, please follow me at Hannah Goes Birding on Instagram. My Twitter is womenbirdershh, or you could email me at womenbirders@gmail.com. I also have resources and information on gobirdingpodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope that we'll see you at the next happy hour.